Okay, happy Purim to everybody. We're just going to be starting the class shortly, in just a few moments. And we're going to address the Purim story, take up the highlights, and some questions. And we will start approximately 2 minutes, just after a brief sound check, as we did before all the classes. If you miss any part of the class, you will be able to hear it in its entirety by going to the audio link and clicking on the today's class at any point. And we just ask that once you hear the audio feed, just type in audio okay at the bottom of your screen. They'll confirm for us that you're picking up the audio feed properly. And the only real text that's necessary today will be the actual Megillah, the Purim Megillah. And throughout the class, we'll have certain points where we'll pause, either for questions to hear your responses, or if you have any comments. But other than that, we request that you hold off on any type of entries in the chat feature, just so none of your questions or your important comments are missed. And also we ask that you just keep the chat to the subject matter. Okay, we'll start in about a minute or so. We'll just wait for friends to call in. And we hope everybody's having a happy Purim so far. And Stephen in London, Hannah in Florida, thank you very much for the audio confirmation. Good, Doug. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you.
Good to hear. Good morning, Cal. How are you?
Great.
We should have a few others joining who haven't gotten on yet.
Okay, well, wait a moment. We'll wait a moment.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll be doing the Megillah today, the Purim story. Some interesting points from the Talmud that also embellish and give us insight into organ appreciation.
Good morning, Bill.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
Oh, we're doing fine up here. Getting adjusted slowly but surely.
A big adjustment.
Yeah. I miss you guys.
We sure miss you too.
Yeah. I heard you guys had some rough weather down there, huh? Up there, I should say.
Ask the kids, they have a different perspective on it.
Oh, they like 10 inches of snow, huh?
Yeah.
You'll tell me when you're ready to start.
I'm really glad we live on this hill.
Doug, you let me know when everybody's signed on. We'll start.
I think we're probably ready to go, Rabbi.
Okay.
Brad, Mary, are here.
Oh, good morning, Brad and Mary.
Hi, Brad. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Mary.
Good morning to everybody. Okay. All right, so why don't we do a brief summary, if that's possible, of the actual Megillah story, and then we'll interject with some of the comments of the Talmud and try to understand what the real significance was and why it necessitated a new holiday and what qualifications it passed for a holiday as well. So as you know, at this era, this was subsequent to King Nebuchadnezzar, and Ahasuerus was now in power. He was actually became in power because he married the queen. And I believe that she had tormented him a bit, teasing him that he was a stable hand. So he was making a large party. He was now king of over 127 provinces. And he made a party for 180 days. So it gives us a picture into the nature of Ahasuerus, who was very much a hedonist. And at the party, at the beginning of the party, it talks about all the beautiful marble and the drapery that he had lined in his gardens. You could imagine what a scene that would be to see, you know, beautiful marble and variegated marble and tiling on the floor, on pathways, beds of gold and silver, and wine he would give that was older than the guests. And I once suggested, why was the idea of giving wine to your all of your viceroys and all of your princes that's older? So let's take that as the first question. What would be the king's ploy in giving wine to each one of his princes that was older than each one was? So he found out the age of each person and would give them wine that was older than them. For what reason would he do that? All right, so that would be the first question. We'll pause there. You can't move too far in Torah without a question.
Is it possible that he's trying to impress upon them that even though you're old and you may have a lot of wisdom, you know, I have wine that's older than you, and sort of trying to establish his power over them?
Yes, very good. That was too fast, Doug. You got to show you're working on it for a little bit. You can't just be that fast. Exactly. I mean, he wants to. It's basically a power struggle. When the king is interested in keeping loyalty at the same time, you know, letting them know who's boss. So you give them something in order to keep their loyalty, something valuable. At the same time, it will humble them because this wine was around before you were. So it has a. It can have a dual purpose. And that's exactly what a king has to do. He has to approach things in both ways. It's the push and pull. Okay, so they're drinking, and the Angelo's office is there, and they're all now. The next thing that happens in the party is that they're discussing whose wives are more beautiful, and of course the king said, no, my wife Vashti is more beautiful than all of yours. So they said, well, bring her out here and let her dance in the nude. So he calls for her, and at this point, she refuses. Now here comes the next question. The reason why it says that she refused is because it says Gabriel the angel, the Talmud says this, Gabriel the angel had attached a tail to her. Okay? So again, we know all these types of depictions in the Talmud are metaphoric. So we have to understand what the metaphor is. She didn't really have a tail, but there's a concept here that the Talmud is trying to tell us. I think there are two ideas. So the question is, how do you approach this type of a statement? What does it mean that Gabriel came and attached the tail to the queen? And that's why she didn't want to come out and dance. But we know, factually from the Talmud, that Vashti used to work the Jewish women in the nude. She was very much into this type of a promiscuous lifestyle. And if she was so attracted to this type of lifestyle, so certainly this was something that she shared herself. So if she did, what was the reluctance at this point to just be involved in it and maybe even a greater audience? If she could be the exhibitionist that she really is. So, but here it says that Gabriel prevented her from dancing by attaching a tail to her. What does that mean? Right, if anybody on the screen, anybody who's joining us online today, has an idea, just type it in at the bottom of the screen so this way we can see. Okay, so I'll pause here.
Rabbi.
Go ahead.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Oh, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but maybe I'm answering a different question. Is it possible that she used to ask her Jewish women to work in the nude because it was, again, a power kind of thing, but for her to be sort of on the receiving end of that, in her eyes, demeaning for her, and she didn't want to do that?
Right, it was demeaning for her, true. But we know that that doesn't mean that she really had a tail attached to her. And Hannah in Florida is asking who would want to dance around with a tail attached to them. She didn't want it to be thought as being imperfect. But Hannah, we're understanding this as the rabbis tell us, that this is a metaphor there was truly no tail attached to her. So we have to understand what that means.
Have I?
Yes, Carol.
It implied that there was some sort of a blemish or something, and she was embarrassed by it and therefore did not want to expose herself.
Okay, what would the blemish be?
Well, I don't know. It could have even been a pimple or something. I don't know.
Well, there's definitely cover-up stuff for that. But that's not something significant enough that you would have that recorded as Gabriel causing a tail to be attached to her. So give me half one second. Give me one moment.
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Rabbi?
I don't think so. I think he just said be back in one moment.
Okay, good. So again, I hear what you're saying, Cal, that when it says that Gabriel came and attached a tail to Vashti, to the queen, and that's why she didn't come out. Normally she would have, but now she didn't come out. So what is this has to be some significance here. And I agree, there's some sort of a blemish, but... And somebody's asking, I think Joshua in Indiana is asking a good question. A tail seems like something, like an animal. Why a tail? Josh is on the right track. Joshua in Indiana just wrote that on screen. Alright, so Josh in Indiana is making a good first step. A tail seems something animal, and I'll just emphasize a point, and that is that if you think of any organ, any appendage, or any part of a being, so a tail is the one thing which a human doesn't have. Animals have everything else that we share. We share the same thing. But a tail is the one thing which only an animal has. And Rosora is mentioning something changed in her way of perceiving nudity. Okay, I would agree, but you have to take it further. The question is really, the right first step is, what does it mean that Gabriel put... And what? Well, you also have to ask, what does Gabriel mean? Drew? Everybody has the question, right?
Hey.
Okay. So I'm just going to repeat it one more time because I just have a surprise guest who's just delivering some shalach manos. It's one of the mitzvahs of the day to give food for a meal for to your close friends. So my chavrusa Chaim had just stepped in with a beautiful bottle. I'm not going to even look at it yet. So I just want to fill him in on the question. So the question is that when they were having the party, now Hashverosh was having the party. So they were all boasting about their wives. So Achashverosh boasts about his wife. Of course, Vashti is more beautiful than yours. And they were all different countries. So he says, no, my wife is the most beautiful. So his viceroys or his other fellow officers said, well, bring her out and let her dance in the nude. So he called for her, but she refused. And the reason why she refused, the Talmud says, because Gabriel attached a tail to her. So what does that mean? He attached a tail. I mean, it's a metaphor, of course. But let's take Joshua's approach. He says that a tail is indicative of something animal. Now let's take that as the first step.
Rabbi?
Yes.
A long shot, but...
Sometimes a long shot is a good first step.
If Vashti were to dancing naked in front of a whole crowd of people, it seems kind of reduces you to an animal-like presence. as opposed to if she were to, say, dance naked in front of her husband. And so maybe her refusal was that she did not want to be put on public display, sort of like you would put a show horse on display.
Good. And I just want to mention Rosora in Italy is also saying the same point, that she associated nudity with like a very low, or you're saying sort of like an animal instinct. She didn't want to do something that wasn't part of, I guess, part of the union of a husband and wife, so then there's certain things that are acceptable. But to do it as outside of that framework, you're saying, where for other people, it's more like you're, it's too much. Right. But the other interesting thing here is that it says that Gabriel attached the tail to her. What does that mean? Who's Gabriel? So Gabriel is one of God's angels. Now, we understand from Maimonides that an angel means something which, and the Hebrew word for angel is malach. And malach also means malacha, which means work. So something which performs a function in terms of God's will, that's what an angel is. An angel could be wind that split the Red Sea open. An angel could be a force of nature that brought the hailstones down in Egypt. And an angel could also be a certain force psychologically which makes the person feel too instinctual, too animalistic, which is the case over here. So she would have come out. The Talmud is telling us that she did work the Jewish woman naked. So she had this type of an attachment in this type of a lifestyle. However, now we're being taught that God was now stepping into the picture. We know that God's name is nowhere in the Megillah. And there's a reason for that. I want to say once is that we see that at the end of the Megillah that the Jews, it says, Kimu v'kiblu mashu kiblu kavar, that they rose up and they re-accepted the Torah lifestyle out of a love, whereas by Sinai, earlier, they had accepted it, but out of a coercion. It says that God held the mountain over their heads. It's a medrash, it's a metaphor. God didn't really lift up the mountain. That would have been part of the actual story itself, if that was true. But it means the events at Sinai were so clearly a proof that God exists that there was a certain element of coercion when they accepted the Torah. But here, the Jews accepted the Torah at the end when they saw the wisdom of Mordechai and Esther and how it worked out. And they were so impressed with this type of a lifestyle that they were so in love with the Torah system. So it says they rose up and they accepted it now out of love. So, in order to perhaps effectuate that, God minimized any type of overt type of miracles in order that the people can emerge with an attachment to the system purely based on what they saw with their intelligence, without being oppressed or coerced to follow because of outright miracles. So over here, it was essential that Vashti be removed from her position in order that Esther can be put into place. So God was creating the remedy before he created the illness. He made sure that Vashti was in place, that Vashti was removed from her place, so this way the cure, meaning Esther, a very intelligent woman, could be in the proper status that she had direct connection with the king. So that's what it means that Gabriel attached it. It means that God sent a certain force psychologically to cause Vashti on this moment to refuse, and she was not worthy of living anyway, so God didn't do anything more to her to cause her death than she did her on her own. So there was no injustice in that respect. But God knew how it would play out, that Haman would now stand up and say that, oh, we can't let this be, there, we must send out letters that every man has to be the ruler in his house, and that a woman can't refuse her husband. And Ahasuerus liked it, so they sent out the letters. That itself, the Talmud also says, if it wasn't for that first letter, then the Jews would have been completely destroyed. Meaning, when people started to receive this letter, that the man is supposed to be the ruler in his house, so all the people that were in the 127 provinces that Ahasuerus ruled, they looked at the king as being an imbecile. Because they said, of course the man's the ruler of the house. He's a breadwinner. He's stronger physically. Whatever their male chauvinistic society was back then, it was something which was it was a no-brainer. For the king to have an edict to tell the people that you're the ruler of your house, they looked at the king as being foolish. So So therefore, when the next letter went out to destroy the Jews, everybody was lax. They didn't pay too much attention to it until the final day. So we see that that statement of the Talmud as well. All right, so far so good. Should we move on?
Rabbi, one question.
Go ahead, Doug.
In the Tanakh that I'm reading, there's a footnote that says Vashti did not refuse out of modesty. She refused because God caused her to break out with leprosy. And Megillah 12b is quoted as a source.
All right, could be there's another view as to exactly what took place, that she had a something about her appearance, or the way she would appear. So it's an agreement with what we're saying, just a different permutation.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Sure. Okay, so now the next thing which happens in the story is they have a Haman gets into power. There's a couple of smaller events that only small, not insignificant, but small because they take up very little space in the actual text. But one is that Haman is promoted in power, and he makes a rule that the king agrees to, that everybody should bow down to him. And also that they made a whole festive beauty pageant in order to select a new queen for the king. And part of that, there was another very interesting thing there, is that Mordechai told Esther that when it comes to the time that it's your turn to go to the king, don't tell him where you come from. Don't tell him your nationality. What was the reason for that? And just as before we get to that, it's important to know that Mordechai came down with the Jewish exiles not because he had to. He came down because he was such a righteous person. He wanted to make sure, and he saw what was going on. They originally came into exile because the Jews outwardly prostrated to the idolatry of Nebuchadnezzar. So the Talmud says that since they only outwardly did it, and they didn't really believe the idol was anything worthwhile, so God also only outwardly was going to punish the people. He didn't really mean to destroy them, but God wanted to move the people back to repentance. So Mordechai went down with the Jews in exile because he wanted to be of assistance. And what happened was that once Haman was promoted, and Haman had the Gemara says that he had an idol around his neck, and everybody had to bow to Haman, but Mordechai didn't bow. Not only that, Megillah says he didn't even move. That's something else if somebody recognizes you but doesn't bow down, but if the guy doesn't even budge when he sees you, it's like you're not even there. So that was something which was completely intolerable to Haman, the egotistical person that we'll see later on how egotistical he was. But why did Mordechai do this? Why was he putting the Jews in jeopardy? Was it right for him not to listen to the king's viceroy here, Haman, whatever his status was, and now put the Jews in jeopardy? But evidently, Mordechai realized that it was because of this, even this outward expression of acceptance of idolatry that the Jews expressed, even though they didn't accept it inside, even that is something which they were now wrong to do. And that's why they were going to be punished. And Mordechai was trying to demonstrate that even something like that you can't do. So that's precisely what he did not give into. He did not move or bow down to the idol that was around Haman's neck, or to the other view that Haman himself made himself out to be a deity. But Mordechai openly resisted and would not give in to this, to show the Jews that this is your mistake. Mordechai was trying to get the Jews to recognize the real flaw. So when it came to another case where the Jews might succumb to that, now Mordechai said, no, you don't bow down to this. And this is how far you go. These are the three areas that the Jew is not allowed to commit this sin, even if he's going to be risking his life. Okay. So now, we see why Mordechai came down with the Jews. And we see that Haman's now elevated in status. But we see already that God put Esther in place. And then now, the question we asked is, why did Mordechai tell Esther when it comes to the time that you're selected to have that night with Achashverosh, don't say where you're from? Why not? That's the question. I'll pause here.
Would it be so that she's not automatically excluded from potentially being queen?
How would that work?
Well, if Haman gets wind that she's Jewish, he could probably influence the king to disqualify her.
Okay. I mean, he could also, they could push her to say, listen, either you'd say nationality or you're not going to be part of the pageant. But she, on no grounds, gave in. Now, if we're going to say that it was risking her life, I'm just wondering how that plays in there. You're saying that if she did stay where she was from, that it would be, what, ruining her chances?
Yeah, I'm assuming it would ruin her chances.
Okay, so you're thinking that Mordechai was telling her not to reveal in order that she gets to be queen, not avoids it. Right?
Right.
Okay. So why would Mordechai want her to be queen?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because, I mean, he doesn't see yet, presumably, how this is all going to unfold.
Unless he does.
Does?
Unless he does. Unless, perhaps, he does see how it's going to unfold. To a certain extent. I mean, the view that I heard was on the same objective as yours, but a completely different path. I'm not sure who said it, so I'm not going to quote. But the idea of not revealing who you are creates more of an intrigue and more of an attraction. So it was along what you're saying that Mordechai wanted Esther to become the queen. And evidently, the reason for that is obvious. This way you can be closer to the king and be instrumental in helping out the people. So you get that position, then that's just another card you have in your hand. So I agree with you. But it's interesting how Mordechai's inside, he's using the psychological ploy over here. Don't reveal everything about yourself. Keep something hidden. That intrigue is something which causes the king to have more interest in you over others. And I think also, if I'm not mistaken, she didn't use the perfumes at all. So there was like not trying too hard type of approach. Somebody who shows like a casual interest or no interest, that's the person you're interested in more. It happens to be true psychologically. If somebody's being chased by somebody else, it's an easy win. You know, I don't, you know, I must be better, and I don't need the person like that. So that was the idea over there. And then, of course, we got to keep in mind that there was a plot against the king by Big Son and Seresh that Mordechai just happened to hear. I mean, of all the people in the kingdom, he was the person that's passing by when these two people are talking about it. So here, right away, you see a little bit of the a peak of the God's providence. Because how did it that he just happened to be the one that heard it? And he told Esther, and Esther told the king, and they wrote it down in the king's book, but evidently nothing was done for some reason. Maybe Haman was in charge, and he was the one that didn't want to reward Mordechai, because Mordechai was the one that didn't respond to him. But now let's get to Haman a bit more, because this is where the whole crux of the story is. Because of Mordechai, and he was so angered by the fact that this one person didn't bow to him. So it says in the Megillah that He found it despicable to just try to attack Mordechai himself, because that's below. You know, a king of the United States, the president of the United States, it's going to look very, very small of him to try to take a revenge on an individual citizen because they said something or they did something. It's below you to do that if you're the president. And Haman had the same thing. But he couldn't deny the feeling because he was such an egomaniac. So he devised this plan where he'd say it's really the people, and they don't follow your laws. And the Talmud says that These people, if a fly would fall into their wine, they'd take the fly out and keep on drinking the wine. But if the king would touch the wine's glass, they'd spill it out on the floor. So he had certain knowledge of Jewish law, and Haman was right about that. So he used that in order to make the Jews out to really be like vermin in the king's eyes. And the king, you see, as well, that Haman wanted to give, I don't know, was it 30,000 kikar, or a very large amount of silver, to wage, to pay for the annihilation of the Jews. And the king says, no, keep your money, I'll pay for it. So you see that Ahasuerus was just as evil as Haman was, even though the story makes him out to be less. And part of that knowledge was necessary because it says also in the Talmud that when Esther was, once the decree came about for the Jews, so now, you know, Mordechai was wearing sackcloth and crying out in the king's gates, which you're not allowed to do, but again, this is something which he didn't receive Esther's direction, because Esther was now the queen, and she sent clothing that he should, you know, dress properly. But he says, no, you can't do this, and this is something which has to be, the Jews have to recognize what's going on here. And he says, you have to do something. Mordechai sent a message back, says, you have to do something to save the Jews now. Esther said, well, I can't approach the king without being called. I'm sacrificing my life. And Mordechai said to her, well, if you don't do it, don't think that your house and your family will be saved. God's salvation will come from another area, another direction, if it's not from you. So Esther responded and said she accepted, you know, Mordechai's directive. And she said, okay, tell the Jews to fast 3 days with me, and then I'll approach the king, and I'll devise some sort of a plan. So, meanwhile, Haman is very, still, you know, very disturbed at Mordechai, and so Esther devises this plan, and she says to the king that you should come to a party with you and Haman. I'm going to have a drinking party. But just the three of us. So, of course, whatever the queen says, up to half the kingdom he's going to give there. And of course he agrees. And he comes to the party, and there with Haman. Haman feels so big. Oh, just me and the king are coming to the queen's party. So when they get there, the king says, all right, what is it that you want? So Esther says, I want you to come to a second party I'm making with just you and Haman. So what is Esther's plan? Why doesn't she just say to the king exactly right now, my people are in danger, we're going to be destroyed, and get rid of Haman? But she doesn't. We have to understand her plan. God didn't make way for Esther to be put into place because she was a nobody, or she was a typical Jew. Here was a woman that had a very keen intelligence and a very keen understanding of psychology. So what exactly was, let's ask this question now, there's the next question. What is the plan of Esther to invite the king and Haman to one party, only to tell them at that party that she wants them to come to a second party? What's her plan?
Rabbi?
Yes, Cal.
Seems that she wants to create more mystery. She's in control of the plan, and therefore she's, in a sense, got the power in the situation. And perhaps she wants to make Haman a little bit more unsure. And, of course, the king is probably just delighted because he thinks that this is a fun game.
Well, you see, the king is not so delighted because it says that night the king could not sleep. And he opens up his book of remembrances, right? And he's going through it, and he comes across the story of Mordechai, who informed the king through Esther that there was a plot against his life, and they found out, and the king was saved. So he asked his servants there, what has been done to Mordechai because he saved the king's life? So they said nothing was done to him. And at that very moment, who is in the courtyard of the king, in the garden of the king? It's Haman, and he's coming there because he took the advice of his family, that make gallows and hang Mordechai on them, and you'll get rid of him that way. Because Haman was still so fuming about Mordechai. There's one person that just didn't recognize him. So he's in the courtyard precisely at the same moment that the king is reading about how this very Mordechai saved his life and nothing was done to him. So what is he saying? He says, let Haman in. And he asks Haman, Haman, my friend, what should the king do to a person who he loves to honor? So why was the king asking him this? But you look at the Haman's response. Oh, you should put him with the king's clothing and let him ride around on the king's horse, wearing the king's crown. So the king sees into Haman's personality now. And he sees that Haman is here trying to knock off somebody who supported me. Haman also, of course, must be thinking that I want to give glory to him. That's why he's stating this. So he says to Haman, you go ahead and do this to Mordechai. Don't drop a word from what you just said. Parade him around on the king's horse with the clothing and the crown, and recite, shout out loud, such is what the king does to those who he likes to give honor to. So he was a completely humiliated Haman at this point. You see then how God's providence is working within the two individuals that are using their wisdom to live the best that they can. So then God works with you. It's a very big lesson that if a person is living intelligently, of course not everything is in our control. Very little is in our control in life. There are just too many variables and too many factors that go into all the events of a single day. So it's necessary for a plan to have its fruition that a person is just achieving on his own. No, God has to step in order to really bring it about. But as long as the plan is in line with God's will, and we see the plan was in line, because Mordechai's whole initiative here was to get the Jews to repent for this feigned idolatry. So we see how now the scales are tipping a bit now. Now Haman is now praising Mordechai and has to parade him around. Go ahead.
Do we assume, I have always assumed when I've read that account of the nighttime meeting between Ahasuerus and Haman, that Haman never gets around to telling Ahasuerus what it is that he wants.
That's right.
He never realizes that. Do other commentators presume differently?
I'm assuming that he did say that. The actual Megillah narrates that, although it doesn't say that he communicated it with his mouth. It says it as though it's just a narrative. Let me just get it. Hold on. It is, let's see where that is.
Like it's about chapter 6, verse 5.
6:5. Okay. Okay, so it's the king says, who is in the courtyard? The Haman Ba, and it sounds like a narrative. Haman came to the courtyard, to the house of the king, the outer courtyard, saying to hang Mordechai. And then it says in the next verse that the Nari Hamelch, the lads of the king, said to him, Haman is standing in the courtyard. Now, what was told to him, I don't know. Let's see. Good question. Don't know. I would assume that he did, because it seems the response is vindictive right now. The response to Haman seems vindictive, and it doesn't make sense to be vindictive without some sort of a provocation.
Yeah, I suppose it would be natural for the king to ask why in the world Haman's standing in the courtyard in the middle of the night.
Right. Right. It also shows how how much of a short fuse and, you know, how unstable the Haman was. In the middle of the night, he couldn't wait till a proper hour to approach the king. He has to disturb the king in the middle of the night. I mean, it's clearly been like, because he couldn't sleep, so he brings the book. Because Haman, Ahasuerus, excuse me, was wondering, well, what's going on with Esther and Haman? Is there a plot against my life? Or perhaps there's somebody I didn't reward, and that's why he brings the book. Right. So then they finally get to the... But what's? Let's get back to Esther. What was her plan? Why did she ask about that? See, what I heard, I think it was Rabbi Chait who explained this, a beautiful idea, that what Esther was doing was she realized that if she would just approach Ahasuerus and accuse Haman and without really priming him, so it would be tough to really get to convince him that his right-hand man is doing something evil, and it wouldn't go over well. So what Esther's plan was is to get the king into a state of mind of suspicion of Haman. And with that suspicion, it would be easier the next time, because now he can't sleep at night, and something's bothering him about Haman. And now Haman's coming in, and he wants to get rid of this guy who really saved my life. So we see how the providence is working in line with what Esther's plan was, to try to get Ahasuerus looking at Haman in the bad light. And then, the next day, so Esther invites them, and she finally says why she invited them to the party, and she says, the reason I invite you both here is because there's somebody who's out to kill me and my people, and if we were just going to be sold to slaves and this and that, I wouldn't have bothered you, my king, because then it wouldn't have been worth disturbing you. But it's because of our lives are on the line. So he says, who is this man that is out to do such a thing? So she says, she picks up her hand, and she was about to point to Ahasuerus, it says, in the Talmud. I mean, this is 3 days where she did not eat anything day and night. And they were fasting and praying to God. So, but she knew that Ahasuerus was just as evil as Haman. But if she would have, you know, I guess it would have been the weakness of the 3 days that she was pointing initially to Ahasuerus. But the angels came and moved her hand to point it towards Haman. Again, God's providence stepped in order to assist, because if she would have pointed to Ahasuerus and accused him, then she would have ruined all the chances of salvation. And it's a very odd point in and of itself, that she was going to point to the one person that could really help the Jews. So it is a very interesting, I don't have an answer to why she did that. But nonetheless, she says it's Haman, and Ahasuerus gets up from the drinking fest with the three of them and goes out to his porch. And then the Talmud says an interesting thing. The Talmud says he's going out to the porch and he sees angels that are uprooting trees throughout his garden. And he says, what are you doing to the angels? So they say back, well, Haman told us to do this. What does that mean? Again, it's not literal, so we have to interpret it. He was already primed by Esther to be suspicious of Haman. And now she says that he's trying to destroy her and her family. So what did Ahasuerus really interpreted that to mean? He's after the throne. He's taking my kingdom, my trees. He's taking up the beauty of my expanse of the land. So it doesn't mean that he actually saw trees being lifted up out of the ground, of course. But it means that he was now looking at the kingdom and seeing how is it going to play out? His fears were overtaking him. Because if Esther said that Haman is really out to kill my people, so why does Haman want the queen? He really wants to get the queen because he wants to get to the king, ultimately. And he already saw that Haman wanted to wear the clothing of the king and ride around on the horse. So now Ahasuerus was just putting together with his own insecurities and his own paranoia that any king has to have by nature. And now when he hears this from Esther, oh, he's really not after just Esther and the people to kill them, but he's really after me. And it's as if he saw his kingdom evaporating before his eyes. That's what it means, the angels. Meaning to say that it wouldn't have been something that he did normally, but when it says the angels were causing the trees to be uprooted, it means that God was now putting a certain amount of fear into Ahasuerus more than what his own personality demanded. That's what it means when an angel is part of the story. It means that it was something super added to the events. Normally, Ahasuerus would not have gone this far. But God, just like Vashti would have come out and she would have danced, but God sent some sort of a force psychologically that inhibited her. So here also, God sent a certain force psychologically which aroused an exaggerated suspicion on Haman. And we see that even that was not enough, because as soon as he has his fear outside the porch, so he comes back in from venting a bit outside, he comes back in, and what does he see? See, Haman, while Ahasuerus went out to the porch to cool off, so to speak, so Haman was terrified, and he fell on Esther's couch and pleaded for his life. And he got up. And the Talmud says, I think, a few times he got up, and the angels pushed him back on the couch. Why did the angels push him back on the couch?
He'd be there when the king walked back in.
Exactly. And why did he have to be there when the king walked in? And he says, and he sees Haman on the couch, and he says, "You're going to conquer the queen with me in the house? I mean, you're going to take and sleep with her while I'm here in the house?" Meaning it would not have been sufficient, even with seeing the angels outside. It was a double-pronged approach that was needed right now of God's providence. It was not sufficient that he just imagined Haman uprooting all the trees, meaning overtaking the kingdom. But it had to be also in terms of the sexual as well. It had to be in terms of the wife too. Meaning, in order that he really came to some conclusion with Haman, he had to have, Ahasuerus had to have a view of Haman that he was reaching into everything. That's how far it was. For some reason, it was necessary with Ahasuerus, not only that he viewed Haman as taking over his kingdom, which is represented by the geography. So he saw things in the topography. In the metaphoric sense, being destroyed. He saw the trees being destroyed. My expanse of my kingdoms, this guy is after. But that was insufficient. He still, in order to really be a clincher, it was necessary also that he came in and he saw a picture that this guy is trying to take over my wife as well. So that's why it was both. That's why his angels were involved in both areas. Okay, so we see, and at that point, Harvona, who was a supporter of Haman, switched sides right away. And he said that King Ahasuerus, you know that Haman had a tree that he built to hang Mordechai. So Ahasuerus says, hang Haman on it right now. And they did. So we see how, with Esther's intelligence and her cunning, and God working in it with well, because it was necessary that Vashti was removed in order that there could be a new pageant and that Esther can become the queen. It was necessary that Mordechai just happened to hear the plot of Bigson and Seresh. So we see how the providence was involved, but yet it was essential that God was involved for the salvation of the Jews, and that's why we were able to make the holiday. And as we asked at the outset, what demanded that this become a holiday? So we see how God's hand was involved. It wasn't just the military prowess or the political prowess, we should say, of the Jews. No, we see that God was essential to the story. But what we see is that when individuals are living and in tune with the Torah principles, and standing up against idolatry like Mordechai did, and using all the psychological acumen that both Mordechai and Esther did, because Mordechai said, don't reveal who you are, that'll make you more attractive. And Esther also played with psychology, and she realized that if she gets the curiosity piqued in Ahasuerus's mind, now he's going to be primed to really accept when I say that his second man is really against his beloved wife here. So when we see that people are living in terms of the Torah system, God steps in. That's something which we see in the Chumash also. Rabbi Chait had given a class on after Jacob had left 20 years at the house of Lavan, at the house of Laban. And he finally succeeded and got his family together, and then they finally had a treaty because Laban chased after them and finally overtook them. And he said, what are you leaving? You didn't tell me you're leaving. Da-da-da-da. And they finally made a truce, and Laban went back his way, and Jacob went with his 11 sons and his two wives and two concubines. At that point, it says that Jacob, he saw the angels of God, and he called the place the encampments, plural. What does it mean, the encampments? Machanoyim, the encampments. He saw how, because God had come to Laban the night before and says, I know you're going after Yaakov, but don't say either good or bad to Jacob. So God warned, because God knew that Laban had the ability to destroy, and Laban wanted to kill Jacob and his wives, and they killed. He was a lunatic. He lost it. So God stepped in for the salvation, and Laban finally catches up with Jacob and says, "You know that I can do harm to you, but your God appeared to me in my dream last night and said, don't do good or bad to you." So when Jacob heard that, he said to himself, if Laban is really delusional, he could have thought that he had a dream with God telling him. But all he would have dreamt about is a dream where he was reprimanded, meaning all he would have heard was don't do bad to Jacob. Meaning to say, if Laban's own unconscious, his superego, I should say, his own guilt, if Laban's own superego would have, you know, been bothering him in the dream because he was intent on wiping out Jacob and even his children, his grandchildren, he would have done it. So, but if it was only a dream that he thought that God gave to him, so all Laban would have had a dream about is God telling him not to do anything bad. But the fact that Laban told Jacob that your God told me not to do bad or good, now Jacob realized something. This had to be God. Because Laban would have never thought in his dream, if it was his own development, if it was his own psychology, Laban wouldn't have thought that God's going to tell me not to do good to him. That would be something that a person's guilt would say to him. You understand? Is that clear?
Yeah.
But by the very fact, this is Rabbi Chait's point, very, very good insight. But by the fact that Jacob heard Laban say, don't do good to him, as well, now Jacob knew this had to be God. And once he knew this was God, now Jacob reflected and realized that with all my cunning and everything I did to get the sheep and the speckled and the spotted sheep and to amass this wealth and to be safe at this point, it's not only my own doing, it's God. That's why Jacob named the place two encampments. My encampment, but the encampment of God also. Meaning to say that it was through my work and God's work together that I was able to reach this point and have the success and the safety. So the very same lesson that when a person is living the best that they can with his intelligence, God steps in to assist that person. So that's exactly the story over here of Purim and why it warranted to be a holiday, because of the salvation of the entire nation on a national level. Because by Jacob, it's true the nation wasn't formed yet. Here you had the nation, and here you had where there was a complete salvation, and they realized, due to these events unfolding, that God was involved. And then the Jews recognized this as well, and that's why it was they re-accepted the Torah now, not out of a coercion that they did at Sinai, when they were just overcome by miracles that there's no doubt that God is doing this. So then you have to accept. That's coercion. But God really wants, on Purim, is that he brought the people to a state where they just loved the whole system, and they saw how by using intelligence and following the real principles and going against idolatry. You could even do that. Yes, you can denounce idolatry. You shouldn't have bowed down to Nebuchadnezzar's idol. That's why you're now having this this whole tragedy going on, and you really shouldn't have. And if you live by the system, you see how God can step in and work things out. So they love the way how God designed the whole experience of life for the human being on earth, that if you live properly, God can step in and he'll work out things for your success to have the right life. And when they saw this, without any coercion of overt miracles, then they re-accepted the Torah out of a love, and they completely embraced it. And that warranted a holiday. Okay, let me pause here for any questions or comments. See if it covered. Okay. All right, there was another point that I heard parenthetically, that the reason why Esther wanted to have the 10 sons of Haman hung also is that she wanted to make a political statement, and now this whole movement is over. Now, just in terms of wrapping up, we have the laws. Well, what are the laws that exist on Purim that we're going to be involved in later on today? So, the verse says in verse 9:22, it says that it's an interesting verse. I'll read it to you. It says, so afterwards, it talks, when they sum up at the end of the Megillah, so they established the 14th and the 15th to be holidays. You're all familiar with that, right? That it's 2 days? Okay. However, there's a rabbi in the Gemara, Rabbi Samuel ben Nachmani, the son of Nachmani, and he says something in the following verse. I'll read you the verse. First, let me just read you the first verse. It says, to establish upon them that they should make the day the 14th of Adar and the 15th, every single year, it'll be a holiday. The next verse, listen carefully, it's 9:22. As those days that they rested, or they had a reprieve, the Jews had a reprieve on them from their enemies, and the month that was reversed to them from anguish to happiness, from mourning to a holiday, to make them into days of drinking and gladness, and sending portions of food each man to his friend, and gifts to the poor. So Rav Samuel ben Nachmani says on this verse, what does it mean in the very beginning, as those days which they rested on them? What he learns out from that is that just as the 14th and 15th are days where you could read the Megillah, Rav Samuel says you could make two more days. As those days, as the 14th and 15th, two more days will be added to the holiday, which mean the 11th and 12th would be permitted for people to read the Megillah, which is a very interesting thing, but we don't have the permission to read, to eat matzah on the 11th or 12th of Nisan of next month. We have to wait until the night of the 15th to eat the matzah. Otherwise, it's not considered a command at all. Why is it, though, on Purim that Rav Samuel ben Nachmani saw fit that we can preempt the actual days of the 14th and 15th and even read the Megillah on the 11th and 12th? In addition to that, in this one verse, and I say this to you a couple of times, but it's a very important thing to keep in mind when we're studying, every verse that we have in the Torah or in prophets or in the writings like the Megillah is, if there are a number of ideas in one verse, that means that they are related. There's a common theme that will tie all those ideas together, and that's why they are in a single verse. That's one of the methods that God teaches us by. So in this one verse where we have the extension of Purim back to the 11th and 12th as well, you also have the laws of drinking and sending food to giving food to your friends, your close friends, and charity. And it also says an interesting thing, that the month that was reversed from anguish to happiness. What do you mean the month that was reversed? So I want to say is that perhaps along these lines, there's maybe a very interesting concept, and I'm only suggesting this because I can't say with a real conviction that this is a true concept in Purim, but it might be. But I'll suggest it. And it's as follows that if the day itself, the real significance of Purim, was that the Jews reaccepted now out of a love. Now it was no coercion anymore. Now they saw the system and they loved the system at the highest level. And we see that this is really God's objective for us because the Shema prayer says that you should love your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. The operative word there is the word all, meaning a total consuming immersement in the attachment to God. That is a level that a person can reach. And we see what level that Moses reached, 40 days and 40 nights, he didn't eat or drink. Of course, there had to be some miraculous intervention, but the fact that there was no interest in food was something that you have to merit Moses for. He was totally consumed at that point in receiving the Torah. He was in communion with God, and this was something which was completely satisfying, and there was no attention that was being diverted to anything else. And this is what the Shema tells us to do. And we see the Jews did reach that level here at Purim, that they were completely enamored by the system, and they arose and reaccepted the Torah out of a love. Now, if that's the case, perhaps Purim carries with it the idea of drinking, because what you want to do is show the state of what you are. Again, Rabbi Chait explained this idea, that when you drink on Purim, it is to mimic the state of euphoria, where there's like an unbridled love, an unbridled attachment. And when a person drinks a certain amount, all his inhibitions are removed from him, and there's a certain freedom and a happiness that he reaches. So we drink in order to mimic the state of the Jews back then. Of course, also, they had drunk, and it's part of the party as well. But now, if we just take that a step further, not only is that something which you can express in the internal world of the emotions by drinking, but you might even say that this is not something which can be bound by time. To say that I'll have one day a year, or 2 days a year, whatever, that I express this complete attachment to the system, it still is inhibited by the fact that you're only limiting it to a few days. So maybe the very idea that Rav Samuel ben Nachmani was saying was that Purim has in it the character that you can extend the amount of days to embody the concept that the complete, pure, and unbridled attachment to God and His Torah system cannot be something which we can delineate fixed days. So by saying that we can have appendages of more days shows this idea again. And you see that the very verse that we're discussing, it says that the month that was turned from anguish to happiness. What do you mean the month that was turned? It was when they won. It was the 13th. It was one day that they finally had the victory. They celebrated in one location on the 14th, and they celebrated in Shushan on the 15th. But what does the verse mean, the month that was turned? You see that it's telling you a psychological insight into how people view when certain events. And we see that there's the concept that we say that when it says Mishenichnas Adar Marben Besimcha, from when the month of Adar commences, then you even start with your happiness. Don't even wait 2 weeks later till Purim. Even from the beginning of the month. What does this mean from the beginning of the month? It means to say that this concept of the attachment of the unbridled love for the system can start weeks beforehand, because when we start thinking about them, we enter that realm, time of the year, we can't just limit it to days, because that really goes against, that's the antithesis of the very expression. The expression has to be unbridled. So therefore, we don't limit it to fixed days. So that's why it says the month that had turned from anguish to happiness. And that's why we also have the principle from when other starts. And my friend Rabbi Pinchas Rosenthal mentioned to me that even by Passover, we say in the Haggadah, we say the words, one might have thought that you would start these laws from the beginning of the month of Nisan. Ah, so now we have a parallel. It's not only by Purim, but it's even by the redemption that we had in Egypt. We have this concept that you might think that you even preempt a holiday weeks beforehand. Because when the month enters that contains that holiday, already it has the flavor of that salvation. So I'm just suggesting that this concept of this happiness, and if we could really identify with the feeling of what Mordechai and Esther and all the Jews experienced at that time, then we identify that with our drinking to help, you know, to create some sort of a similitude to that euphoric state. So then that state is not only something which is an internal thing that we mimic with the wine just today, but we could even start feeling that the feeling of thankfulness and happiness that we had our lives saved. And that would even commence from the beginning of the month. And that's why you could even have earlier days added onto Purim, to embody that idea. Okay. Let me pause here. Any comments or questions?
Rabbi, are people prohibited from reading the Megillah except during the Purim time?
Well, they could read it, but it's not going to be for the fulfillment of the mitzvah.
Ah, okay. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, learning is never... Only one day is prohibited. Tisha B'Av, we're prohibited on learning for things that are outside of the mourning category. But other than that, no. But it is a very interesting verse, if you look at it. 9:22, there's a lot there. And again, what's the idea of sending the portions of food to your friend? It has to be a close friend, Rabbi Chayyad explained. Why? I understand that to mean that's the type of person that you really can create, that's the real currency that friends want more than anything, is the friendship. And when you bring food over and you have a meal together, that's such a nice experience. So you want to bring that state of euphoria even higher in terms of not only your own personal drinking, but you're now with a friend and you bring him a good meal. And not only that, we have to be concerned about who else? The poor people. But the poor people, the currency that gives them gladness is literally currency. That's why we give them money. So in terms of the recipient of our goodness, it depends. There's a certain currency for each one. For our good friends, it's that meal. We give them a meal, a nice meal that they can enjoy. It's our friendship. And that's why you should fulfill it by, you know, going to a close friend and fulfilling that. And in terms of the poor people, since that's really what they need and you don't have a relationship with them, but what makes them really happy is you put your hand out to them and you give them a smile and you commiserate with them, because part of giving charity is not just the money. The Shulchan Aruch says it openly. You must commiserate with them. You have to talk to them and comfort them and remove them from being demeaned. So it's to give the person the proper ego in order to get back on their feet. That's why the highest level of charity is to establish them with their own self-sufficient work. Okay. All right, any other questions or comments? Beyond this or anything else in the Megillah at this point? Because that was pretty much what I wanted to present today.
I think we're good.
You're good. All right, then. Well, let me wish everybody a good day, a good Purim, and that, look forward to, I guess, Sunday next week we'll pick up. And I'll try to give you some advance notice on what we'll do. If there's anything more that comes up, usually after the fact, so you think about it more and you have some more ideas. So I don't want to say yet what we'll do next week. We may do something more in the Megillah, maybe something on the past week's Parsha about the temple or the king's, excuse me, the clothing of the high priest. That's what we just read about this past week. We didn't really touch on that yet. So I'll be in touch with you during the week. All right. And from, we're getting regards here from somebody in the Netherlands. They're saying happy Purim to everybody, so I'll repeat that over to you. And again, happy Purim to everybody. And Doug, Cal, Brad, Mary, who else is with you guys today?
Yeah.
Bill?
Bill Longo.
Oh, how are you doing, Bill?
That's all right.
Okay, glad to have you with us.
Yeah, well.
All right. And we'll pick up
same,
okay, we'll pick up same time next week then.
Okay, Rabbi, thank you so much, and a happy Purim to you and everyone.
Thank you so much, Doug. I really appreciate it.
Take good care. Thanks for
ideas.
Okay. My pleasure.
Be well, everyone.
Okay. A lot of it was Rabbi Chait's ideas. I want you to
know.
Great. Okay. Be well.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so that will wrap it up for today. I'm glad everybody was able to join us online. We'll pick up next week, 11:15, Sunday morning. I think we are moving the clock, so make sure you check that out and correct that. 11:15, I guess, daylight savings as of next Sunday, if I am correct, if that's what we're doing. All right, a happy Purim to everybody. And to fulfill the command today of drinking properly, the Rambam says that there's no real reason to overdo it. Drink until a little bit more than what your normal drinking is, until you fall asleep because of the wine, and you fulfill that state that they talked about. Okay, Yitro, good to see you. Don, thank you very much. I'm glad everybody was able to join today. And if any of you missed any part of the class, this will be online shortly under the audio link, and you'll be able to listen to it in its entirety. Okay. Happy Purim Chag Sameach to everybody. Bye-bye.